I still command respect in some. In most, though, all I inspire is fear. His eyes were unfocused, his voice thoughtful. I am not a good person, Amara. I have had reasonable success as a First Lord, but I don't have their compassion, only resolve. Amara only stared at the First Lord in silence. He rarely spoke of himself in a personal sense. It was at moments like this that Amara felt the real difference in their ages, for though Gaius looked like a man in his mid-40s, perhaps graced with early silver hair, he was in truth approaching 80 years of age. He had seen a lifetime of intrigue and betrayal, and no small share of personal tragedy of his own. She had grown used to the image he projected, that of a man of fantastic power, inhuman will, and effortless personal and political grace. It was in moments like these that she was reminded of what he truly was, a weary and almost viciously lonely old man. Amara had made mistakes enough in her young life to give her a small but steady burden of regrets. Gaius's decisions affected many more people than her own. How many regrets did the old man have piled upon his aching shoulders? How much darker were the dreams that came to haunt him? How many times over decades in the treacherous world of Alaran politics had he longed for someone to turn to talk to lean upon, knowing that there was no one, and never would be. Not after the death of his wife and son, the last of the ancient bloodlines in the House of Gaius. Everyone looked at the First Lord and saw exactly what he wished them to see, the leader of the realm, the power, and the riches. Only in the last year of working with him had Amara realized how unutterably alone Gaius truly was. It took extraordinary courage to lead the life he had lived, to endure in the face of all the problems, the enemies, the demands placed upon him. Even if she had the fury craft to do it, Amara would not be the First Lord for all the riches of Alara. She drew herself up, faced him squarely, and said, "I serve you, sire." Gaius regarded her intently for a moment, then briefly put a hand on her shoulder. "Countess," he said, "it is entirely possible that I am not worthy of such loyalty. Summon the coach."
"Yes, sire."
Amara raised one arm and flashed a hand signal at a group of knights heiress of the Crown Guard waiting on a nearby wall. The men secured harnesses to an aerial coach and lifted into the air, descending to the landing ground with the First Lord's coach, along with an escort of a score of knights heiress in the crowns scarlet and blue. Gaius traded some words with the commander of the knights, then entered the coach. Amara came in after him. Wind roared, and the coach rose up and away from the fortified town. Amara took a moment to regard the Ellen Arch, rising in a graceful arch over the grey-green waters of the slow, deep, steady Tiber. At one point in her life, Amara thought, she would have resisted anything but a direct command to ride in an air coach. After all, why ride when one could be reveling in the power and freedom of flight? Granted, that was before the First Lord had her flying over the entire width and breadth of the realm for most of 2 years straight. After being worn to exhaustion over and over again, Amara had come to the conclusion that perhaps a little bit of decadent relaxation while someone else did the heavy lifting might not be a bad thing. She had no intention of making a habit of it, but she'd worked hard enough to earn the occasional respite, especially given how long it had been since she'd seen Bernard. Amara sighed. Bernard, her secret husband. Cursors were supposed to devote themselves solely to their duties. Cursors served the First Lord and the realm, and their devotion was expected to be selfless and undivided, though, like active legionaries, who were also supposed to remain unwed, cursors generally took lovers. The only thing truly forbidden was marriage. Of course, that was precisely what she had done. Amara should never have allowed herself to fall in love with the formidable Count of Calderon. Regardless of how steady and caring he was, how strong, How handsome, how patient and loving, how passionate and skilled and... Amara's heart sped up, and she arrested her train of thought before she began to blush. If love was so easily overruled by banal reason, it would not be love. "Thinking of the good Count Calderon, Amara?" Gaius asked her. His eyes glittered with amusement. "You don't know it was him," Amara replied. "Perhaps I've taken a dozen new lovers by now." The First Lord's mouth quivered. Then he erupted into a rich, genuine bellow of laughter. It didn't last before he subsided, belly shaking, to stare out the window of the coach.
"No," he said. "No, not you."
Amara took a moment to compose herself. She often forgot that Gaius was as skilled at watercrafting as he was with fire or earth or metal. Worse, he was a perceptive individual who had been dealing with people two or three times as long as Amara had been drawing breath, all of which meant that it would be all too easy for him to discern awkward, potentially dangerous specifics. Her relationship with Bernard was a dangerous topic of conversation around Gaius, especially since it felt like it had been at least 10,000 years since her husband had touched her, or kissed her, or made her cry out in... Crows take it! She was a grown woman! It was entirely unfair that simply thinking of Bernard should reduce her to a starry-eyed schoolgirl like that. Amara cleared her throat, took her notebook from the cabinet built into the base of the seat, and proceeded to change the subject. "Very well, sire. We should arrive back in the capital sometime early tomorrow morning. The reports from High Lord Antelus should be waiting for you when you arrive, and the final movement orders for the Rhodesian legions should be in effect by then, which..." The coach swept into heavy cloud cover, and she paused to murmur a fury lamp to life.
"Countess," Gaius said gently before she could.
The First Lord reached out and folded the notebook shut, setting it aside.
"Come with me, please."
Amara blinked at him. Without preamble, Gaius turned and opened the door of the coach. Wind howled in a sudden scream, whipping their clothing about, and the coach slewed slightly to one side as the sudden drag made the coach's progress uneven. The First Lord stepped out into empty air, lifting away from the coach so smoothly that he might have been moving out onto solid ground. Amara lifted her eyebrows but followed him, summoning Cirrus to support her as she left the confines of the coach for the cold, clinging, dark grey dampness of the heavy clouds. They kept pace with the coach for a moment, and Gaius exchanged a nod with the leader of the accompanying knight's heiress. Then he slowed pace, and within seconds the air coach vanished into the clouds, leaving Gaius and Amara hovering alone in featureless grey. Gaius flicked a hand through the air, and the roar of wind suddenly vanished. For a second, Amara expected her wind stream to collapse and send her plummeting toward the ground, but Cirrus's support remained steady. Her hair still whipped around her head, as it always did, especially in a hover. Only the sound vanished, dying to nothing more than the sigh of a quiet breeze. Around them, Amara could hear the distant grumble of thunder, as somewhere miles away a spring storm gathered in the cloud cover. "Sire," she said, confused. "The coach." Gaius shook his head.
"I'm sorry I couldn't tell you before, Amara, but secrecy was absolutely imperative. No one can know where we're going, when we left. Nothing."
She frowned and folded her arms against the ongoing winds. She wasn't wearing her flying leathers, and she was surprised at how quickly a chill began settling into her skin. "I take it we're not returning to the capital," she said quietly.
"No,"
Gaius said. She nodded. "Why am I here?"
"I need someone I trust to come with me."
"Where, sire?" Amara asked.
"Calare,"
Gaius said quietly. Amara felt her eyes widen. "Why there?" His voice stayed quiet and steady.
"Because I've been sitting in the capital playing diplomat for too long, Amara. And this chaos.
He gestured with a hand, taking in the entirety of the realm beneath them,
is the result. Allies and enemies alike have forgotten who I am, what I am. I can't allow that to go on any longer.
Lightning flickered somewhere in the distant clouds, sending a flood of silver light through the swirling mists behind the First Lord.
I'm going to remind them, Cursor.
His eyes hardened.
I'm going to war, and you're going with me.
Chapter 5. Isana made sure her hood was well up, and was grateful for the unusually sharp chill that lingered in the springtime morning air. It gave her an unquestionable justification to have her hood around her face. She wasn't trying to avoid being seen visiting Captain Rufus Scipio, precisely, since the director of the relief column would quite naturally need to speak to someone on the First Alaran's staff. But Tavi felt it was better if she went unrecognized and attracted no notice or questions at all, and she heartily supported his caution. As promised, Araris was waiting at the front doors and escorted her past the two legionaries on sentry duty there. Good morning, she murmured as he led her into the building. It was an almost ridiculously over-fortified structure, all of the same battle-crafted stone that was generally used only for fortified walls. The halls were more narrow than most, the ceilings lower, and Isana noted with surprise that at the first staircase, Araris led her down, not up, to where a leader's quarters were typically located.
Good morning, he replied.
His posture and voice were both politely formal, but she could sense the warmth that lay beneath them, radiating out from him like heat from a banked fire. She was certain that he knew she could discern his actual emotions as well, and the sense of sudden satisfaction in that unspoken trust was a pleasant little thrill, something akin to feeling his fingers intertwine with hers.
We go down 2 flights to get to his office.
Did the senator displace him? Isana asked. Araris shook his head.
The Khanim sorcery evidently proved quite dangerous. Some kind of lightning bolt wiped out the First Alaran's original offices. When the Legion's engineers built this building, they made sure to put yards and yards of fortified stone over and around the captain, to avoid any repetition.
Isana shivered. She'd heard about the attack. If Tavi hadn't been sent out to run messages for then-Captain Cyril...
I see, she replied. Araris snorted. The valets set up Arnas on the top level. I suspect they're privately hoping that the Khanim will try another lightning bolt and brighten everyone's day.
Isana repressed a wicked little smile.
Sir Araris, she chided, that isn't a very kind thing to say. Arnie doesn't have kindness coming, Araris replied.
Isana felt a gentle surge of contempt flow out with the words.
You know him, she said.
We went to the academy together, Araris replied.
You didn't get along?
Oh, he was at my throat constantly. Whenever I wasn't actually in the room, he said. Arnas never had anything to say to my face.
Araris reached up with one hand to rub lightly at the mark branded over one cheek.
He was always small-minded, egotistical. He hasn't changed.
He's dangerous, Isana said.
Isn't he? Here? Now? Very.
He came to a stop before a heavy closed door, and turned to look at Isana. She met his eyes, and her mouth suddenly felt dry. He reached down and took her hand gently in his. He squeezed tightly once.
You can do this.
She bit her lip and nodded.
What if?
He laid 2 fingers lightly over her lips and gave her a quiet smile.
Don't borrow trouble. Just talk to him. He loves you. It will be all right.
She closed her eyes tight for a second and brushed the faintest ghost of a kiss against his fingers. Then Isana took a steadying breath, nodded, and said,
Very well.
Araris turned and opened the door for her.
Captain, he announced quietly. Steadholder Isana to see you.
A resonant, deep-chested voice answered in a tone of distracted confidence.
Thank you, Araris. Send her in, please.
Araris gave Isana another small smile, then stood aside, and Isana walked into Tavi's office. Araris shut the door behind her. The office was supremely utilitarian, even stark. There was an old wooden desk, scarred from use, several chairs, and several shelves filled with books and papers and writing materials. The cold stone floor was covered by a few simple rugs, and a box beside the lit fireplace was filled with a neat stack of cordwood. A door led off into another room, and a plain medium-sized mirror hung upon the same wall. He sat at the desk, a quill in hand, scrawling something hurriedly across the bottom of a page. There were several stacks of them spread across the desk, evidence of what appeared to be several hours' work. He finished writing, set the quill aside, and rose with a broad smile. Isana stopped in her tracks. The man who stood up was enormous, even taller than her brother Bernard, though he had a more wiry build and the slenderness of youth. His dark hair was cropped short, and he wore a suit of battered legion armor and a sword on one hip. His features were angular, strong, attractive, though a fine white line across one cheek spoke of a wound too severe to heal without leaving a scar. Tavi's eyes, though, had not changed. They were green and bright, lit from within by the intelligence of the mind behind them.
How like his father he looks, Isana thought.
Aunt Isana, Tavi said, and wrapped his arms around her.
She was about to caution him to be careful, but he was gentle, making sure not to crush any armored steel ridges against her. She made up for it by hugging him back as hard as she could. He was real and safe. She hadn't seen him face to face in years, but there was no mistaking that he was her son, no hiding the genuine burst of warmth and love and delight that radiated from him as she hugged him. They stood like that for a time before Isana broke the embrace. She lifted her hands to cup his face, her eyes swimming with tears, her cheeks already aching from smiling.
Hello, Tavi.
He kissed her on top of the head.
Hello, Auntie. It's been a long time.
She leaned back to arm's length, looking him up and down.
Longer for some than others, she teased.
Goodness, you've grown even more. What do they put in the water here?
He grinned. Yeah, it sort of snuck up on me. But I think I've stopped growing finally. These trousers have fit me for almost a year.
Thank goodness.
If you got much taller, they'd have to raise all the ceilings in here.
Tavi shook his head gravely.
Nonsense. This is the Legion. The ceiling is at regulation height. It is the responsibility of every legionare to be sure that he is regulation height as well.
Isana laughed.
I'm glad to see you haven't lost your sense of humor. Never that, Tavi said. My mind has been gone for a while now, but that's no reason not to laugh at things.
How's Uncle, His Excellency?
Bernard is well, as are the folk at home, which reminds me. She untied the pouch from her belt and opened it, rustling through several papers before she drew out a folded, sealed letter.
Frederick asked me to give this to you.
Tavi smiled and took the letter. He cracked the seal and his eyes flicked rapidly over it.
That girl he rescued, eh? Beritta must be miffed. How's that working out for them?
About the way most marriages do.
They have a lot to learn about how to treat one another.
I'm glad for him, Tavi said. If I get time, I'll write something to send with you when you go back. But in case I don't, would you give him my congratulations?
Of course.
Tavi smiled at her and gestured to the fireplace, where a kettle hung from a hook, close enough to the flames to keep the liquid inside warm.
Tea?
Please,
Tavi drew out a couple of the room's chairs, putting them close together, and held one of them for her. Then he took a pair of tin cups down from a shelf and poured steaming tea from the kettle into each. He added a spoonful of honey to Asana's, the way she liked it, then splashed three of them into his own before returning to her. They shared a cup of tea, chatting quietly about people and places back home in the Calderon Valley. They talked for a time of Tavi's duties at the Ellenarch and of Asana's journey in assembling the relief column until Tavi rose to get them both fresh cups of tea. When he settled down again, Asana said, "Tavi, I hope you know how proud we are of you, your uncle and I. You've grown into a remarkable young man." He blinked at her a couple of times, then carefully studied the surface of his tea. Isana's sense of his emotions revealed pleasure in the compliment and pride, along with large helpings of embarrassment. His cheeks coloured slightly. "Well," he said, "I couldn't have done any of it without you and Uncle, teaching me, preparing me." Isana felt a little stab of guilt. Preparing him was probably the single greatest thing she hadn't done. She sipped a little more tea and then frowned down at its surface. "Tavi," she said, "is it safe to talk here?" He cocked his head slightly to one side, and she felt the spike of curiosity that flashed through his thoughts. "Yes," he said with total confidence. "No one can overhear us in here." "Why, Aunt Isana?" Isana took a deep breath. "There's something we need to talk about," she said. Tavi's face turned red again. "Look, a lot of that is just rumour. I mean, the men get to talking over drinks and every little story grows in the retelling." Isana blinked at him. "I mean, it's not like I'm hosting revels or anything. Everyone likes a good story like that, though, and the truth of it isn't as much fun." "Tavi," Isana said in a firm tone, "what in the wide world are you talking about?" Tavi froze with his mouth open for a second. Acute chagrin flooded out from him in a wave Isana could practically see. Then he swallowed and said,
Nothing?
Isana arched an eyebrow at him. Tavi sighed, blushing again.
"I was talking about Kitai. She and I..."
"Ah," Isana said. "You're together."
Yes.
"In more than one sense of the word, I take it?"
"Well, yes," he said miserably. "But it isn't like we're... I mean, some of the Marad are, sort of indiscriminate when it comes to that kind of thing, and a lot of their riders are around me every time I move around, so it's inevitable that some idiots are going to start spouting rumours about it, but it isn't really like that."
Tavi paused to take a breath.
"Kitai and I are just... together."
Isana sighed.
"Stop. Neither one of us wants you to elaborate, Tavi."
She turned her teacup idly in her hands. "Well, this could become very complicated. I should have had this talk with you sooner."
Tavi said.
He might have become a fully grown man now, but Isana was familiar with his uncomfortable squirming. He'd always done that when he'd been caught red-handed as a child.
"You don't have to have that talk. I had that much figured out by the time I was 10. I mean, caring for the sheep and all."
Isana shook her head and surprised herself with a quiet laugh. "No, no. Not that talk," Isana said.
"You don't understand..."
She was interrupted by the sound of the door opening. She turned to find Araris standing in the door.
"Captain," he said quietly, frowning. "We just got word from one of the men. Senator Arnas's singulares are on the way to see you."
Tavi's chin jerked up sharply.
"Why?"
Araris shrugged.
"No details yet. They're up at the front door now."
"This seems like a good time to speak to Maximus and Crassus about this week's training schedule. Send a runner to them."
Araris thumped his fist to his heart and departed. Tavi bit his lip, glancing around the little office. He opened the second door behind the desk and said,
"Auntie, could I convince you to wait in my chambers? I'd just as soon not explain to the senator's flunkies what you're doing here."
"Of course," Isana said, rising. She paced quickly through the door. It was difficult to see much without any lamps, but the modest-sized chamber looked as functional and stark as his office, except for the rumpled, double-sized bed. If nothing else, she supposed, the legions had done that much for him. Anyone who could convince Tavi to keep his room clean couldn't be entirely bad. Tavi shut the door most of the way, put a finger against his lips in an entirely unnecessary gesture of caution, and then returned to the office. Isana heard him putting the chairs back into position and heard a tinny clink as he presumably placed one of the teacups back onto its shelf. His shadow moved across the narrow opening of the cracked door and he settled down at his desk. Paper rustled. A few seconds later the door opened again and several sets of heavy footsteps entered the room.
"Just leave my breakfast tray on the shelf," Tavi said in an absent-minded tone. "And none of your nagging. I'll get to it when I get to it."
There was a short, hard silence, broken only by the sound of Tavi's quill scratching on paper.
"Excuse me?" said a woman's voice.
It was a quiet voice, one used to speaking in soft tones and whispers, but to Asana's ears it carried such malice and barely contained rage that she actually flinched away from it.
"Oh," Tavi said. "I beg your pardon. You aren't the valet."
"No," said the woman's voice. "I am."
"Did the valet send my breakfast with you, by any chance?" Tavi asked, his tone innocent and friendly. "I'm starving."
"He did not," said the cold voice.
"I'm sure he meant to," Tavi said. "Do you think you could yell up the stairs and see if it's on the..."
There was a loud, sharp sound of impact, a hand being slammed down onto the surface of Tavi's desk, Isana judged. There was a rustling, sliding sound of a neat stack of pages slithering off the edge of the desk and onto the floor.
"You are not funny," said the cold voice, "and I will cut your throat before I tolerate any more of it. Do you understand me?"
Isana shifted position slightly. She couldn't see the woman Tavi was talking to, but she could see his face in profile. He sat in his chair, hands on his desk, and regarded the speaker with a calm, remote expression. There was no mockery to it. There wasn't anything to it, despite the fact that his life had just been threatened, and it chilled Isana a little to see that expression on his face. He appeared to be relaxed and confident, and she couldn't catch even a hint of his true emotions.
"I understand," Tavi said quietly, "that if you continue to show disrespect, unbecoming a soldier, ignoring even basic military courtesy, such as knocking on a commanding officer's door before entering, and speaking to me in that tone, I'll have you bound to a flogging post until the ants can crawl up your hair to get at your eyes."
There was another pause. Then the woman's voice said,
"You don't know who I am, do you?"
"Or care particularly," Tavi said.
"My name," she said, "is Navaris."
Tavi's expression never flickered, but this time Isana sensed a pulse of surprised recognition and then a low current of tightly controlled fear. Tavi leaned forward and said in a congenial murmur,
"It's possible that playing Singulare for the senator has not brought you the fame you'd hoped it would. Never heard of you."
His eyes stayed steady for another strained, silent moment.
"Well, Navaris, when you first walked in, I assumed you were here for the decor and the charming company. Now, though, I'm thinking that you might have had something else in mind."
"Yes,"
came the answer.
"How exciting. Maybe you even had a specific reason to visit."
"Yes,"
Navaris growled. He glanced past Navaris, eyes scanning the room.
And these four? I take it they're here to help?
Yes.
Tavi sighed and sat back in his chair.
Navaris, this will go a lot faster if I don't have to play guessing games.
His voice went flat.
Tell me what you want.
There was another long silence, and Isana realized with a sudden flash of panic that, as Tavi had sat back in his chair, his hand had slipped around behind it, and his fingers were on the hilt of a dagger that had been secured to the chair's back. There was something thick, even drunken, about Navaris's voice when she finally answered.
Senator Arnos sent me to gather up your intelligence reports on recent activity in the occupied territory. You are to turn over to me every record, every copy, and every list of information sources for the Senator's personal review.
Tavi shrugged his shoulders.
I'm afraid I can't help you.
These are orders, Navaris replied. If you refuse to obey them, it's treason.
Which is punishable by death, Tavi said. I vaguely recall reading as much somewhere.
Give us the papers, she said, or you are under arrest.
Isana's heart pounded hard in her chest.
I don't think so, Tavi said. You see, Navaris, I'm afraid you don't have a leg to stand on, legally speaking. You're a singulare. You aren't an officer. You sure as the crows aren't my commanding officer. In fact, you aren't in my chain of command at all.
Navaris's voice came out as if through clenched teeth.
These are the Senator's orders.
Oh, Tavi said, nodding as though at a sudden revelation. Then they're in writing. Let me see them, and the papers are all yours.
He lifted both eyebrows.
You do have legal orders, do you not?
After a brief pause, Navaris said, You saw him. He resisted arrest.
There were several harsh masculine mutters.
Get your fingers off that sword, Singulare, Tavi said, his voice an abrupt whip-crack of authority. Draw that weapon against me, and I'll gut you with it.
There was the sound of several blades slithering from their sheaths, and Isana leapt to her feet in sudden terror.
A new voice broke into the conversation. If I were you, Araris said in a level tone, I would do as he says.
Or not, said a bluff, cheerful voice that was laced with a desire for violence.
Angela Maximus.
If you all want to dance, I'm game. None of them got to draw steel before we did, said a third voice,
that of a young man Isana didn't recognize.
If things start up now, they won't even get their weapons clear of their sheaths. That doesn't seem fair. Right you are, Crassus, Max said. Right you are.
Isana felt a surge of murderous fury from the room. Navaris, she felt certain. It was a white-hot anger. Something that seethed with malice and hate so intense that it almost seemed a separate entity. It was an irrational, bloodthirsty thing, a kind of madness that Isana had only encountered twice in her entire life. For a moment Isana felt sure that Navaris would attack in any case, but then that raging fire suddenly died into stillness, snuffed out as quickly as a candle dropped into a pond.
"You think you've accomplished something here?" Navaris said quietly.
You haven't.
You'll see that in time.
Tavi looked at her as if she hadn't spoken at all.
Please convey my apologies to the Senator that I could not act without confirming his orders. Regulations can be inconvenient at times, but they are, after all, what holds a legion together. Thank you for your visit.
Fool, Navaris said.
Captain Fool. Tavi responded. Good day, Singulare. Araris, Crassus, please escort the good Singulare and her helpers to the door.
For a second, nothing happened. Then there was a shuffling of feet, and then the shutting of a door, then silence. Isana leaned against a wall and closed her eyes, her heart racing, slightly dizzy at the sudden relief both of her own fears and of the intense emotions that had crowded the little office.
"Crows," Maximus breathed. "Was that who I think it was?"
"Phrygia Navaris," Tavi said, nodding.
"What was she doing here?" Max asked.
"Getting humiliated, mostly. Especially there at the end." Max barked out a short, coughing laugh.
"You don't do things by halves, do you, Calderon?"
"It saves me the time of going back to finish later." Tavi rose from the chair and came to the door.
"And speaking of Calderon..."
Isana opened it, aware that her hands were trembling in reaction to the tension of the past several moments. The room was now empty, but for Tavi and Maximus. Max lifted his eyebrows at Isana, and his surprise was palpable.
"Oh, good morning, Steadholder."
"Good morning, Maximus," she replied. At least her voice was steady, she thought. She looked at Tavi. "That woman is dangerous?" Tavi nodded.
"One of the top 10 or 12 swords in Alera." "More like one of the top 6 or 7, Maximus said, his tone serious. "And she's done more actual killing than any 2 blades on the list."
Isana shook her head. "What were you thinking, insulting her like that?"
"I was thinking that I needed to buy time for Max and his brother to get here," Tavi said.
He gave her a boyish grin.
"Relax, auntie. I had it under control."
Max snorted. "Is she acting on the senator's behalf?" Isana asked.
"Probably," Tavi said.
"Then why didn't you give her the papers?" Tavi sighed and began gathering up the fallen pages.
"The papers are going to tell Arna something he doesn't want to hear. I think he was planning on making them vanish."
He straightened them and turned to Maximus.
"Get these to Aaron. I want copies for Sir Cyril, the Senator, and the Tribune Strategica of all 3 legions, as well as to the militia command in town."
Max grunted.
"The staff meeting?"
"Yes.
Once the information is out, Arnos won't be able to lock it up again."
Isana blinked at him. "What could be so important about them?" Tavi raked his fingers through his short-cut hair.
"From what we've been able to put together, I think I have a good idea of what the Khanim are doing. I think if we handle it right, we might be able to call a halt to this war."
"How?"
"Tavi," Maximus said in a tight, warning voice.
Tavi blinked at him.
"What?"
Maximus stared at him, then shook his head and gave Isana an apologetic glance.
"This is pretty important information. I know she's family, but she's also a client of Lady Aquitaine's. It's probably better not to discuss it in front of her."
He glanced at Isana again and said,
"It's mostly the principle of the thing, ma'am." "Crows," Tavi snorted. "Max, she's my family. If you can't trust your family, who can you trust?"
A lance of pure guilt hit Isana in her midsection. The comment was so typically Tavi. He'd grown up close to her, to Bernard, and in the rough frontier country they lived in, toil and hazard built up trust in one another to a much greater degree than in the more settled regions of Alera. As far as Tavi was concerned, in the Calderon Valley, family always supported, always defended, always helped, and always told the truth. He believed it. Oh, it was going to hurt when Isana shattered that belief. It was going to hurt both of them unbearably.
"That's all right," she said quickly. "It was an inappropriate question in any case. Of course, it's better to be careful."
Tavi gave her a searching look, but shrugged and nodded.
"Get a move on, Max. We don't have much time."
Maximus banged his fist against his chest, nodded to Isana with another apologetic glance, and hurried out. Tavi rose, frowning in thought.
"I'm sorry to cut this short, auntie, but..."
"I understand," she said quietly. "I have duties I should be attending to as well." Tavi smiled at her gratefully.
"Dinner tonight?"
"That would be lovely." Tavi suddenly blinked. Oh, he said. I can make a couple of minutes right now if you like. What was it you wanted to talk about?
She couldn't do it. She couldn't bring herself to hurt him like that.
If you can't trust your family, who can you trust?
Nothing important, she lied quietly. It can wait.
Chapter 6
All right, Captain, Sir Cyril said.
He grimaced a little and shifted slightly on his seat, finding a more comfortable angle at which to rest the metal leg that had replaced his own from the knee down.
If you're ready, why don't you lay out what you've learned?
Tavi nodded and stepped up onto the raised platform at the head of the conference room. Though the visiting dignitaries had departed, the room was still crowded, this time with the officers of both legions of the Senatorial Guard and the First Alaran. Except for Max, Crassus, and one or two of the other tribunes in the First Alaran, Tavi was by far the youngest man in the room.
Thank you, Sir Cyril, Tavi said. The First Alaran has been engaged in active operations against the Khanim forces to the south for almost 2 years, ever since the Night of the Red Stars. We repulsed their initial and secondary efforts to take the bridge. Once additional pressure was brought against their eastern flank by the forces of High Lord Placidus, they were forced to divert much of their infantry to the east, and we drove their garrison out of their position at Founderport. The Founderport militia holds the city, and we stand ready to reinforce it should they need it. It's our only stronghold south of the Tiber, but the Khanim don't dare assault it for fear of being pinned between the First Alaran and the city walls.
"We're aware of this, Captain," came Arnas's voice.
The senator, resplendent in formal senatorial robes of blue and red silk, sat in the first row. The two senatorial guard captains sat at his left hand, and Navaris and one of her fellow singulares sat at his right.
"You needn't continue reminding us of your accomplishments. Everyone here acknowledges that you've had some success in your efforts here."
Tavi felt like grinding his teeth together, but kept himself from actually doing it. Crows take him if he'd let this silk-robed dandy rattle him so easily. Besides, his instincts warned him that it would be a mistake to let Navaris see his self-control slide.
Navaris.
The woman was a legend among the cursors, the single most successful and highly paid cutter in Alera. She'd killed 73 opponents in legal duels, another 60 or 70 in fights that were allegedly cases of self-defense. And rumor had it that another 100 mysterious murders could be laid at her feet with reasonable accuracy. And if she was anywhere near as good at covering up her crimes as she was at dodging the legal consequences of her swordplay, Tavi figured that she might have killed who knew how many more, successfully disposing of the corpses afterward. Navaris didn't look as dangerous as she was. She was an inch or two under 6 feet tall and made of whipcord and rawhide. She had colourless grey eyes and wore her salt-and-pepper hair in a short legion cut that did nearly as much to massacre any sense of femininity about her as her lean, hard build. She wore black riding leathers and a long duelling sword at her hip. Her eyes were flat, and they looked at the world as if everyone in it was simply one more practice target set up in a swordmaster's training hall. If she'd drawn on Tavi in the office, he doubted he could have lasted more than a second or two against her. She was also, if Tavi judged rightly, quite insane. He dragged his eyes from Navaris back to the senator.
"Pardon me, Senator. I was only laying out a common point to start from."
Arnas gave him a sour look and waved an impatient hand.
"Get on with it."
Sir Cyril, seated at the very end of the first row, lifted his chin and said,
"Begin with Vorkus Guard."
Tavi nodded. He turned to the slate board behind him and in a few quick strokes drew out a rough map of the region, marking the Elenarch, the Tiber, and Founderport. "Vorkus Guard is a timber-cutting steadhold that's grown into a small town," he told the room. He marked its position about 30 miles south of the Elenarch. "When we were pushing the Khanim from their positions in Founderport, they fought like mad to hold Vorkus Guard." One of the captains beside Arnas, a man named
Nalus grunted.
Walls?
No, Tavi said. No serious fortifications at all, in fact. Not much in the way of defensible geography, either. But we brought them to battle there for 2 days before they finally ran.
Why'd it take them that long to break?
Nalus asked. They didn't break, Tavi said. They retreated in good order, and after 2 days of fighting we weren't in any shape to argue with them about it. Since then most of our clashes have been more like heavy skirmishes than a pitched battle, while the Khanim consolidated their positions. During that time, several of the Crown's cursors who had been sent to assist the first Alaran infiltrated the occupied territory and began gathering intelligence.
What did they learn? Arnas asked.
First, sir, that the Khanim aren't letting everyone leave peaceably as we first thought. They've been holding back members of two professions, refusing to let them leave. Carpenters and shipwrights.
Arnas frowned heavily.
Then their defense of the timber-cutting Steadholt had a definite purpose.
Tavi nodded. They were taking materials. Wood that had been seasoning in storage, mostly.
Seasoned wood?
Tribune Tactica Kellis was standing against a side wall, not far from Tavi.
Why seasoned wood, sir?
Because, Tribune, Arna said in a tight voice, you can't build ships out of green wood.
Tavi nodded, a little impressed, despite himself. Arnas's mind worked swiftly, when he chose to use it.
Exactly, sir.
He turned and marked a point on the rough map, at the very bottom of the slate board, a distance of perhaps 100 miles.
And we think they're building them here, at a town called Mastings. It has a long inlet from the sea, and already had the facilities in place to support the building of 12 ships at a time. We think that its capacity has been expanded.
You think? Arnas said.
It's conjecture, sir, but it stands up pretty well. The Khanim have set up defensive positions at the mouth of the inlet, and they're turning away or appropriating any ships that try to sail to Mastings. Their patrols in the area are 3 times as thick as they are elsewhere, and the main body of their troops is located somewhere in the area. It's difficult to be sure, because they are refusing to let any Alarans into the city unless they're one of the shipwrights or carpenters being pressed into service.
Then how do you know their main body of troops is there? Arnas demanded.
The agents in question tracked food shipments, sir, Tavi said. Either Mastings is playing host to an extremely large number of Khanim, or its people have decided to abandon life as a seaport and take up the cattle trade.
Ships, grunted Captain Nalus again. What do they want with bloody ships?
Tavi answered. The Khane who led the initial incursion, Sarl, ordered their ships burned behind them when they landed. You could see the fires lighting up Founderport from 5 miles away.
Arna scratched at his chin, studying the rough map.
Ships will give them a number of options they don't have now, he said. They'll be able to move swiftly up and down the coastline. The dogs can sail, I'll give them that. If they build enough of them, they'll be able to move their entire force to support Kalare in the south or to keep us running in circles up here.
Or, sir, Tavi said, they might go home.
Arnas turned a look of pure disbelief upon Tavi.
It's possible, sir. The majority of the Khanim now in Alara did not want to be stuck here. That's why Sarl had to burn the ships. And they have their dependents to think about, too. They want what any of us would want in a similar situation. He shrugged. They want to go home.
Arnas simply stared at Tavi, saying nothing. Tavi ground his teeth. The good senator was offering him plenty of rope to hang himself with, and he knew it. But he also knew that he had to at least try. So he took a deep breath and pressed on.
Given how static the conflict has been over the past several months, we might have an opportunity here.
The room was very quiet until Arnas asked, in a polite voice,
"What opportunity?"
"No use stopping now."
"To negotiate," Tavi said.
"Negotiate," Arnas said. "With the Khanim."
Senator, we want the Khanim gone. The possibility exists that they want to be gone. I think it's worth exploring.
Negotiate, the senator repeated. With the Khanim.
They do have an ambassador, sir, Tavi pointed out. Alera has parleyed with them before.
An ambassador who infiltrated a band of Khanim warriors and trained beasts into the capital itself and attempted to murder the First Lord, yes, Arnas agreed. An ambassador who is currently imprisoned and awaiting execution.
Trial, Sir Cyril said in a very mild voice.
Awaiting trial? His guilt has not been proven.
Arnas gave Cyril a scornful glance.
His troops. His people. Even if he didn't plan it, he should have known about it and stopped it. Either way, the fault lies with him.
Nonetheless, it may be an option worth looking at.
I see, Arnas said quietly. After the Khanim have invaded, killed thousands of Alerans, displaced hundreds of thousands, burned cities, and conspired with a rebel in a plot to help him ascend to the throne, we should...
What?
Give them room and board while we build ships for them? Fill their ships with provisions and gifts? Then send them home with our blessings?
Sir, Tavi began.
I can see the advantages, Arnas continued. They would return home and tell their entire race that Alera was so cowardly and weak that not only could we not defend our own lands against them, we were frightened enough to pay them tribute to get them to leave us.
That isn't what...
And in a year, or 2 years, or five, they'll come again, and in far greater numbers. They will demand another round of tribute.
Arnas shook his head.
No. We stop them here. Now. We scour them from the face of Alera. Every last one of them. We show the Khanim that there is a price to be paid for such things as they have done.
Several low growls of approval vibrated through the room. None of them, so far as Tavi could tell, from anyone in the First Alaran.
We might be able to beat them, Cyril put in. But it's going to cost us a lot of men. Men we'll need in the south when we move against Kalare. Men are going to die regardless of what we do, Arnas shot back.
Granted, Cyril said.
I simply prefer that we avoid killing them unnecessarily. As a matter of professional principle.
Arnas narrowed his eyes at Sir Cyril.
I might point out, sir, Tavi added, that even a temporary cessation of hostilities would provide us with more time to gather intelligence and maneuver to better advantage. And more time for the enemy to build attack vessels and become a far more mobile threat. More time for the traitor slaves to train and equip. More time for them to fortify their positions.
Arnas turned a gimlet gaze on Tavi and said,
There will be no negotiation, Captain.
Sir, Tavi said, If you would only give me a little time to contact the First Lord and...
Arnas's face flushed red, and his voice became harsh, hard.
There will be no negotiation, Captain.
But
one more word out of your mouth, Arnas spat, and I will suspend you from duty and have you flogged. Do you understand, Captain?
Tavi clenched his jaw shut on an utterly unwise answer and gave the senator a single sharp nod instead. Arnas glared at him for a few seconds and nodded. His voice dropped back into a calmer register, and he rose.
"Thank you for your report, Captain," he said as he walked to the front of the room. "That will be all."
Tavi stalked over to take his seat at Sir Cyril's right hand.
"Crows take it,"
he muttered under his breath.
"It hardly came as a surprise," Cyril replied.
Tavi growled in his throat.
"Easy," Cyril cautioned him. "You've pushed enough for today. I think we might have gotten through to Nalus, at least."
Tavi glanced aside to the guard captain. Nalus was frowning thoughtfully at the rough map, as Senator Arnas made a little speech about defending Alera from the Khanim scourge. A shiver ran down Tavi's spine, and he looked past Nalus to find Navaris staring at him with blank eyes. The cutter held his gaze for a moment, then gave him an unsettling smile. Tavi looked away and suppressed a shudder of discomfort.
"Gentlemen," Arnas was saying, "we have been on the defensive for too long. We've stood upon walls and bridges for too long. It is high time that we went forth to meet this threat and show them what it means to cross the legions."
That won a lot of murmurs of approval from the room, again, from everyone except the officers of the First Alaran.
"And so, as of right now," Arnas continued, "our offensive has begun."
He turned and drew a bold stroke on the slate board from the Ellen Arch straight down to Mastings.
"We bring their main body to battle and wipe them out before they can get these ships built. We march at dawn, 2 days hence. Prepare your men. Dismissed."
The room broke out into noise as the men stood already talking and began shuffling toward the exit. Within a moment or two, Tavi and Cyril sat alone. Cyril stared at the map on the slate board for a moment, and then rolled his eyes.
"Of course. March directly toward the objective in a straight line," he sighed. "How many strong points does Nasorg have to work with along that route?"
3, maybe 4, Tavi said, "plus a lot of opportunity to hit our supply lines as we march, and then the city itself."
"Can we force through them?"
"Depends," Tavi said.
"If Nasorg is willing to take heavy losses, he could stop us cold."
Cyril shook his head.
"He won't. He'll hit us as hard as he can while keeping his own losses to a minimum."
Tavi nodded. "Bleed us all the way to Mastings. Then bring the hammer down."
"How long will that take?"
Tavi shook his head, calculating. Thanks to Eren's hard work, he'd had detailed maps to work with in his own planning, and he was familiar with the territory they'd be fighting their way through.
"Call it 10 weeks, unless we get lucky."
Tavi squinted at the map.
"And I'm not feeling all that lucky." "A lot can happen in 10 weeks, Cyril replied.
"I should talk to him again," Tavi said, "privately. He might be more receptive to the notion of negotiating if he isn't surrounded by people."
"He's always surrounded by people," Cyril said. "And it won't do any good, Captain."
"But it's so stupid. Nasorg is willing to talk."
"You don't know that," Cyril said. "He's never sent any kind of word suggesting it."
"It isn't their way," Tavi replied. "To a Kane, talk is cheap. Actions are what speak loudest, and Nasorg's actions are clearly stating his intentions. He's willing to work with Alarans rather than simply slaughter them, and he wants to leave."
"Perhaps," Cyril said. "Perhaps you're right. If I was in charge, I'd give what you're saying some serious thought."
"You've earned that," he shook his head.
"But I'm not, and neither are you. If you bring it up again, he'll have an excuse to replace you. Don't give it to him."
Tavi exhaled through his clenched teeth. "There's got to be a way."
"Then find it," Cyril said, pushing himself up out of his chair. "But do it in your spare time. Keep your focus on the here and now. They might not know it, but a lot of people are depending on you for their lives."
"Yes, sir," Tavi said. They exchanged a mutual salute, and Cyril limped out, leaning on his cane. A moment later, Maximus leaned his head in the door.
"Hey there, Captain. What's the word?"
"We're marching," Tavi replied, rising to walk to the door. "Send Tribune Simnea to my office, please, so we can start on logistics. Put the men on notice." He looked up and down the hallway, frowning.
I would have expected Marcus to be here. Have you seen him?"
"Not today."
"When you do," Tavi said, "send him to my office too."
"Yes, sir," Max said.
Tavi went to the slate board and swiped a damp cloth over it until the markings had been erased. It was sloppy of Arnas to leave his marching orders, such as they were, displayed for any idiot to wander by and see.
"All right, Tribune," he sighed. "Let's get to work."